Support for Small Joys comes from the Columbus Foundation, celebrating the creativity that inspires and strengthens the Central Ohio community every day. More at columbusfoundation.org. Support also comes from the Greater Columbus Arts Council's Columbus Makes Art.
WOSU Public Media, this is Small Joys. I'm Hanif Abdurraqib, and today my guest is Richard Duarte Brown. Duarte is a painter and mixed media artist whose work focuses on family, community, and fostering our collective humanity. Duarte's also an educator and has worked with kids across the Columbus region in multiple arts programs for decades, and he is also someone who I love deeply, someone who is in the lineage of Eastside Columbus artists that make me proud to be from that part of the city. In our conversation, we mentioned another person in that lineage, perhaps someone who is the most adored person in that lineage, the great Amina Robinson, who is the legendary local artist, maybe the greatest artist that Columbus has ever had. And in 2022, Duarte was awarded the Amina Robinson Artist Fellowship and Residency from the Columbus Museum of Art. And to kick off our talk, I asked Duarte how he started using everyday objects in his work. Duarte, it's so good to talk to you, man. We were just talking about how we've never actually had a chance to build together, even though we are, of course, we orbit the same community and have for a long time. Like, we've orbited the same arts community, we orbit the same interpersonal community. We, like so many Black artists, have a connection to Amina, and so it's good to finally talk to you.
Wow, good to be here.
I'm really most excited to talk to you about two things. And first is kind of your relationship with found objects that show up. It shows up in your work, but I also know you have a history with that. And for me as an artist, I think my first medium was visual art, even though I was bad at it when I was a kid. But there was this thing about growing up poor where it was like found objects were something you could put on a canvas, be it like macaroni or rice or using shoe polish to make things. So I'm interested in how you formed your relationship with found art, with found material.
It was intuitive. And I'm raised in New Jersey, so we had seashells and the boardwalk and sand. My mother, so I'm a little bit transparent in some things, and I hope I don't go too far, but my mom had a lot of boyfriends coming around, and I wanted one of them to stay and be a father for us, and I had learned how to trace, and every time this guy named Sam came over, I wanted him to be impressed with my art, so I started tracing these pictures, like somebody sitting or whatever, and the pictures didn't feel impressive enough, so I started using shoe polish to make color on it, because we didn't know we didn't have color, and you had to learn your poor, like I think from TV or something, because I think your intuition and intuitivity comes right away. And so it was just chicken bones were there, rice was something you can glue with glue, shoe polish, I wanted to see stuff dry. It just was intuitive. I didn't know. And I didn't know until I talked to a guy named Ben Crumpler, who's an artist here in Columbus. He's still alive.
Mm-hmm.
He told me, he was trying to school me and protect me. He said, don't tell everybody what you do, because he was concerned that my work didn't have the gallery standard of being archival. So, but I didn't know better. I was sassy, because when I say sassy, my brother Lamont and my mother Carmen told me that I would have to go to New York to be an artist, and that everything that was done has been done already. And so I kind of pouted in a quiet way and didn't say anything. But it wasn't that I was shy. It was just that intuitively, I don't know, I just knew that I was an artist and I didn't have to go to New York. And for a couple of days, I think I'm going off the track, but that's what I'm saying is the objects came like that. When a couple of days I was going around, I got quieter and I just made more things, whatever was around the house. So it was like I never knew if it was my mom's, you know, the paper that came out of a shirt, anything that was there that I could put my hands on, spools, you know, old foil, whatever was there. So shoe polish was easy, because you have white shoe polish and you have a brownish, and then you have a black. So I had that. The glue, you can glue something together and you can see the texture arise out of it. And we can use food color to get color. So it wasn't like we had rec centers that had abundance of paints and supplies, but it was just that it was this thing. And it was this kid named, this teacher or this person on TV named Gene London. He's an old school person, and he would tell a story, but he would tell the story with images coming about. And the kids would sit there, and I was glued to the TV watching that. And I always knew I wanted to tell stories with things and stuff while and people in a room. And I just think, and it created a sense of family. So all the objects, every time I see an object, it's sentimental. I have this sentimental connection to everything. Like every time I see old stamps, old coins, old, even food stamps, anything that was in our life, newspaper articles, it was my way to kind of like just hold on to something that was disappearing. It felt like since I didn't know who my father was and I didn't know one of the boyfriends weren't going to stay around. I mean, this is kind of old person talking now, not me, young person, but the little me, the fend for yourself me was like holding on to, like packing up, being ready for the dangerous times to come, to be prepared with something that I could make and sell to buy happiness for us. So that's a lot of stuff to be buried inside of a mind. But our kids are resilient, or young people, they're packed with such a layer of thinking and stuff like that. And I look back at myself, I get to see myself in kids when I go in school now, because they all like, they got these stories right inside of them, every single one of them. But to answer your question, I know I went way around the mountain, but I think that if you get a hold of, it seems like everything was changing, or everything changes, or the package gets redesigned, or whatever you got comfortable with that was in a house was comfortable with you, but or me, and the picking up of the pieces, like the little TV piece, the wishbone, because we had ceremonies like, you know, even if we didn't have everything, we would like at the end of the year get like a penny, nickel, and a dime, eat black eyed peas, and have a wishbone and break it and wish for the better year kind of thing. So those kind of things were my mom's things, and those become like valuable rituals. And I would take photographs and copy them to make scrapbooks about ours, to keep, like to make some kind of scrapbook of us as family, because I always wanted to tell who we were. So it was kind of like, it was just innate in me to do that.
Yeah, yeah. This is something that draws me back to Amina as well. I mean, as you know, to be in her house now, but particularly when she was still with us, was to kind of be confronted is maybe a harsh word, but to be confronted, joyfully confronted by just stuff. I mean, there's no other way to put it other than just stuff, right? Like, because she believed that everything was worthy of elevation, or everything was worthy of repurposing or having a home elsewhere. And so I think I come to you with the question of now in your art making practice, or even then, how did you evolve an art making practice that was built on discernment? You know, I used to wonder this with Amina too, where it was like everything in my orbit, if everything in my orbit can be made into something better, how do I know when to stop, or do I not stop? I feel like in Amina's case, it was like, you don't stop. You just, you know, everything you touch is something else.
That's literally, I got layers of life, layers of stuff, layers of all these different areas and arenas. And if anybody tries to go and figure it out, it's going to like, it may look like junk to them. But everything, I don't throw it away. Put it away. My mom lived, and you can walk in her house. You couldn't find anything, but she knew where everything was. So like that with Amina, like that with keepers of things and stories and narratives and just holding on to the past. Because I think the artifacts that we touch and hold so much, like when someone dies and you take the program bulletin, you save it. So how do you distinguish what's to keep and not? I don't know how. It's just that now I'm trying to categorize it. I have like, when I went to Amina's house, it was after COVID. So toilet paper became precious, and the rolls and tubes were supplies we had with the kids online teaching. So we were getting a bag and grabbing anything you had at home to make something out. Well, a toilet paper tube, if you mold it to a face, you can bend it and paint it. I watched people from Russia, from different cultures, take toilet paper tubes and make these masks out of them. Well, every time I watched somebody do it, my hands got confused more. So I had to stop looking at all the people training and with the teacher that we were online teaching with, and take mine home and make it my way, cut it, do it. And I wanted to have what I called African lips and that nose. Well, kind of like your features. I wanted to have strong, like, features that, you know, sometimes are offensive to some people, but for whatever reason. But so I was saving these toilet paper tubes, cutting the lips. Then I made these faces that go on them. But a lady that worked with me, I told her I wanted gourds, and she brought me these little mini seed gourds, like, because I wanted to cut gourds open and make art out of them, because there's a special thing to them. And so she brought them to me over the summer. And so they were small enough to fit inside a toilet paper roll. They became this raw piece of material that goes on top of the mask. Instead of calling the face a mask, I called it a seed carrier, culture carrier. And then I thought about how, you know, culture was carried from another place, you know, in the seeds in the hair and all that. And you got this idea that seeds grow and they're planted. Everything that you kind of get your hands on to become something that becomes more sacred than you think. So it was a toilet paper roll that was left, but it became this thing that had significance, because it was, at one point it was hard to, you know, well, the fear was that you wouldn't have toilet paper. Then now this piece of roll that's left became supplies, because they were in the house, and it became a thing to trigger other people to use whatever you have around to find what you can do with it instead of, and the time that you take to make something takes you off the fear of getting COVID or being sick or being alone or being where there's, I think the natural therapeutic thing that kicks in from making and writing and pieces like that happen. So I don't know what it is about that makes, I think a spark happens when you ignite into who you're really born to be. And I think being able to look in small things, like things that are thrown away or discarded, and find life in it, I don't know, something just happens and kicks in that's motivating. And these seed carrier thing, pieces, I won't say things, have become like just precious, if that makes any sense to you.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm also interested in kind of this, your life arc as an artist, which has hit at least a crescendo, hopefully not the crescendo, but it's hit a crescendo in the past few years, I think, in terms of notoriety. Now, we all know that, like, notoriety is different than, you know, the work itself. And so you've been doing the work itself for a long time, but it's been really great to watch, particularly because artists are so often told there's a timeline on, you know, on what they can do, or like when they can produce. Production is tied to success in a way. And you've had this, I don't even want to call it a moment. I get so bothered when people call things like a moment. I don't think that's fair to the workers or the creators. And so, but it has been interesting. How has it been for you, I think, to kind of go through an era where you are being celebrated in this way after kind of working for so long in the community and the number of ways you've worked in the community?
I feel even more responsibility. When I was a lot younger, and I'm 65, so you got a picture. There was this thing, you know, Spike Lee hit on it when he did School Days, and you know, it was the light skin, the dark skin, the whatever, you know, whatever. So I knew this girl named Diane that was dark skinned when I was in middle school, and my mind, she was treated better, like worse, because she was darker than other people. So in my mind, where I wanted to be Superman and save the family and the culture, I'm calling it culture now, but save the people, I noticed that dark skinned people got treated better than the light skinned people, by even people of color. And so I was going to marry a dark skinned girl to help dark-skinned people not suffer as much as light-skinned people, because it seems like light-skinned people, this is me as a kid thinking,
right,
got treated better. And so as I got to a teenager somewhere, I was with a group of kids at Shortstop, which is now kind of like Transit Arts, where this lady Jackie works, and Capacity and all.
Jackie Calderon, right?
Yes. So we've been around each other ever since, because, you know, when I would bring kids to her, she was working with the Short North kids and I was working with the other kids. But the thing was, when I went to go meet the kids, I knew that they were me. They were like left alone. They were hungry after school. They all had gifts. They all, you know, had dreams. They all were skipping, drinking, sexing, everything you can do that you can do when you're left alone to do what you can do, right? But I saw in the eye the lion and the lamb, the lion, what I call the lion and the lamb, the beautiful lamb, and the lion that was to protect itself, and all that comes with that, you know, from, you know, because I kind of have a church background a little bit, and that what I'm getting to is one of the kids that I took home, I went where the kids went. They were literally, this is maybe a little bit transparent, but they were all living in their environment. They were underage. They all was buying singles at the corner store. They were all smoking. Mm-hmm. They were all passing the blunt and everything. And I'm in the room full of this is what goes on normally every day. I wasn't there as a cop or as a dad or as anybody except a person that was trying to build relationships with people, trying to see about maybe getting them in school. And one of the kids talked about doing life better. So the next thing you know, I said, if you really want to find a job, I can take you here tomorrow and we got to go get this state ID and da, 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 da. So that's kind of, I didn't go in there with any kind of like, I know that's, you know, that's not the way they teach you, but I don't know. I just knew that it was, that was the way it would work. So I helped this one kid, you know, go get a job. And then I was at home and I got this idea of doing a painting called Pass the Brush. The Pass the Brush was in lieu of Pass the Blunt. So they were going around, Pass the Blunt, Pass the Blunt. You know what I mean? And when I had approached this one kid, I had tried to paint this picture of a person passing the brush, and it was based off a Spanish artist. I can't think of his name. His fingers and nails, is all, the paint's coming through it. It's just beautiful, foreshortened piece where it looks like, you know, he's passing like the torch of liberty and everything, all that. And I'm seeing all this idea. And in me, I saw right away when you pass the brush, you pass talent, career, or whatever. You pass hope. You pass life. It was the whole idea. So I saw this picture of a black kid with locks because of the dark skin story. I go way back to that. I'm just connecting things that make sense to me now. And I saw this kid also, you know, and then when David Butler is an artist in Columbus with Maroon Arts Group, and he did a Forceful Perceptions for Trayvon Martin. And I had been through all the cycles of the older artists painting with the ones that are gone, some of the ones that are still here that don't cross over to the new ones. And then when David came around, him and this lady named Felicia F. Diot, you know, she was doing a show, and then he talked about doing a show. He did a show called Forceful Perceptions about Trayvon. So I wanted to do a piece because I'm gonna slow down. I can hear my wife saying, slow down. My wife, the rambled in my head was this idea after the Rodney King incident to when there's a story about Reginald Denny being beat, this white guy, because of the verdict.
Yeah.
And
right.
But this little old black lady walks over there and tells all these kids that would make us afraid, stop beating that man. It saves Reginald's life. And with all that L.A. riot thing, my response, because it's devastating watching that. Make sure, but I even said, I can feel my stomach just feeling like it wants to fall out of me. And I was driving to a west side and I was talking like, you know, the God on my spirit, like, how do I respond? What do I do if I just bust out white people's windows? Will I really solve problems? And I saw this idea of, it was like comfort my people and it was comfort my humanity. And so I didn't know really how to comfort people, but I saw that whenever we had a tragedy, people came together. So this particular time, Ohio State had lost a basketball game, and all these tall, different color guys were embracing each other with hugs that were like, it's like my mind stood still. Like the picture became like vivid, and it was just, you just seen all these people lay down the point of the game, the loss of the game, to support each other in the loss. So it was like, I saw like this glory of humanity in the midst of a losing that seemed more compelling than anything I'd ever seen. So that was the way I saw and wanted to, from there on, comfort humanity by having these pictures of people hugging. And it would like, you would walk in a room and you would feel the connection to humanity without me telling you. And it felt like the work that I did, when you ask, how does it feel now to be getting some notice, I kept doing this work and showing it. It was like it was rejected. It didn't fit in. I was told by a collector and a buyer, he said, that will never sell in corporate. And he said it again. But it's anyway, it's been used in different ways. But it's just, he meant well, and he's trying to protect me and everything. But realistically, when something's put inside of you, you just have to stick to it, even nobody around you sees it. So like coming at this point in my life and knowing the kids that know me, that heard that said, and knowing when it's time, every time you turn around, I'm painting the live thing, I'm painting this picture of this people hugging because I'm just suggesting something. And knowing that I've been to some sales where older people come in for gift sales, they'll see this picture of a family hugging or people hugging or whatever, just hugging with no faces on it. And the mother or grandmother will come in there, and right away they'll walk around and they'll go and point that one, and they walk out the room because that means that's the one they want their kid to buy for Christmas or their, you know, child. That's when I go to those business. It's just one of those things I experienced along the way. So it's kind of ironic that, to get back to what I was saying, the picture of Pass the Brush, every time I see a black boy or kid, I always see this this leader that I just want to just pour like life into. I just want to say, son, I just want to hug. I want to do all those things that somehow it seems like we're not allowed to do. It seems like if we do that, we're called something or we're treated somewhere or we're not. What's wrong with you? Back off. But it's like somehow my desire was to find black boys that didn't maybe have fathers or authorities or whatever and just be it, because it was like this thing about, I see so many, like I see kids walking around that play basketball at schools. I see them walking around and, you know, sometimes I'll draw them extra in their ball place, but I ever say, do you ever, you walk like a king? You know what the Moors of Spain? I just say things like this because sometimes you just see these kids that don't know you just want to say stuff. So that's how that came. And that's why all the texture's in it. That's why all the stuff is in it. And so he became this figure. And if you ever hear him tell the story, I kept telling him, they're going to know you. And we did these prints and he laughs because none of them sold. And he was thinking I was crazy. And half of the kids that meet me at first think I'm crazy or, you know, and stuff. And then when they get around, they know I'm crazy after they get to know me. But something about the crazy that they think I am, it's just like there's this chance to be loving or, you know, family. And so that's really what I'm trying to paint. And really to getting a chance to be noticed for it, it just makes me want to paint more of it. It just, so the pass the brush comes from these relationships, all these relationships that come from all this. And yeah, that's where that's at. I feel like I went down a long trail just to say that.
That was great, though. That was great. A thing that we both have in common in a way is that we both work with young folks, right? And I think that I get a lot of hope and excitement in seeing the work of young folks as writers kind of evolve once they are given a permission or a, you know, once there's someone, or even if they find this on their own, that says like you have an ability that is worthwhile that people want to or deserve to be witness to. What kind of, you know, what pushes you or excites you in working with young people that keeps, I mean, because you've done it for so long and so long that I think that your impact is, you know, almost like ever present. You know, we're gonna like see a world where you seem to understand that building a lineage is also a kind of archive in a way, you know, building a lineage of writers is also a type of archive. And so, yeah, I mean, what draws you to that, or what keeps you kind of, you know, present with young folks, and what are you getting out of that experience now?
Okay, I got to say this in a way, because if I go straight to the story, I'll cry and can't tell it. So I like to see people eat, and especially kids. And sorry for this deep, my goodness, I don't know why it gets me like this, but it seems like you know, these stories where people serve kids is somebody that the grandma died or the aunt died or someone died, and they had to cook for their little sister or little brother, and they're in charge of the food or they're the administrator. So when they get the food, they get the food, you know, they get a frozen meal or something, and they cook it, and they just bring it like they did you a favor, and they do it in a way that's like almost punishing you, like, I had to do this for you. But they don't know they're doing it like that. When I get a chance to prepare a meal for us as a group, the idea is like, even if I'm going to go get stuff from the store, I kind of just see what the different groups of kids like or whatever. You know, one of my nephews is a Seventh-day Adventist, and one's a Muslim, and someone don't eat pork, and on and on and on. So, you know, you can find like, you know, cucumbers and pineapple and biscuits. You know, you can have them happy ground, and you can have whatever else. But even as simple as it is, it's the presentation and the stringless attachment to it, where there's no strings attached. And it's the love you have in it somehow. And if you sit it in a way, like even if it's in a paper plate, but you put a black tablecloth over there and put it on a table like a celebration, and you put the food in like it's a moment, instead of like the way they do after school lunches and some of the places where they give the free meals, they make them feel like they're giving it to like the Annie people, the people from Annie, the movie, you know, the poor kids, the heart not like ones. You treat them like they're already like, you know, if something's given us to give it in such a way that it's given like, with honor. And I'm just saying that to back into this story. So at Central Transit Art, they all run together. Like Shortstop, we had Airbrush Fridays because, you know, since the kids wanted to learn airbrush, I started airbrushing shirts. And it was a way to, you know, learn something that the kids liked, and a way to keep things going. And, you know, and we had this Friday night thing where the kids would come from Short North now. And this is when the younger kids. Like I had one through what you call the empty nest. When I first met this group of kids, they become like all like sons and family, got on each other's nerves, got mad at me. We forgiven each other and moved on. Because if you work with kids and people and you're really involved, there's misunderstandings. There's if one kid feels like you're close to him and you're closer to another kid. This kid drew a picture. I'll just say their names first because you won't know them. Nobody else will, but somebody that knows me. One came, his name was Shay, and the Dre came by, this other older kid, and then we met, and we went somewhere, and then Shay comes in and draws a picture of me. I had a flat top, and I was skinnier then, and he drew this me. It almost looked just like me, and he did a picture. He said, the dad I almost had, but another kid stole, and it was like this drawing he drew at shortstop, and it was like this awkward feeling of like, it just happened. You know, you're giving your time to this kid and the same kid, and he's feeling like the older kid stole me from because I'm with him now. It was like, he didn't say anything. He just drew it and it was over. It was never talked about again or nothing like that. But I could feel the weight of that. So in the airbrush class, knowing that they're going to come line up. So what I would do, I would ask the kids, I said, draw your design. And so when I was doing it, it was just this chance to say, what do you want on your shirt? And they can bring their old shirt. If they didn't have a shirt, I had some shirts they could wear while I took the shirt off and I painted it or whatever. And I would airbrush what you want on it. So I had to develop this like what shirt you want? Like talk like I was, I wasn't emotional or cared, or like, And then if we did something together, I had to learn. Nobody taught me this, but I learned that when I went to the movies with a kid or went somewhere, when I came back, I didn't say, "Hey, did you have fun?" I would walk in the room like. Anyway, I'll kind of have your demeanor. I will be a calm, you have a demeanor if nobody told you that commands, like you have this calmness about you that I watch, and you don't really get extra hype excited. Where there's a hype excitement that's not real. Like you don't have none of that. Like if I can say that, that's a lot of stuff to me to say. Yeah. We never talk, but I just know you don't have hype excitement. But if you do get excited, it's pure and it's strong and it's confident and it just has a sustainability to it. But a lot of people have hype excitement and they're not dependable. You discern that as a person. As anybody that's had to discern something, you discern that. Well, this kid comes in a room. So I was trying to be not hype excited, but like listen to, because when you're hype excited, you tell people what to do. You say, I want you to want this. The trick is not to say what you want a person to want, is to see what they really want without having to say what they think you think they want. Like to really get a kid or a person to tell you what they really want. No, I've been telling you I like that because you think I like that. I just want you to feel like I like that. But when they finally tell you what they really like, well, this kid was sitting there writing and I was trying to be tough on him. Like, well, what do you want? And he said, how much is it? I said, just write the story out. Like I was trying to talk like that. But then this boy is about 12 years old. He look a little light skinned, because on Friday, usually their hair is cut and they got Jordans or whatever shoes they were buying on or whatever, because we had a little team business and some of the other kids worked and some that was when they did. But this kid comes in and he starts writing what he wanted on a piece of paper. And he said, dear mom, I'm taking care of my brother and sister. I did everything you said, RIP, wrote his name. And I had to do everything I could not to tear up. I'm in front of him. I was like, oh, this is good. And he said, how much is it going to be? I said, I got this for you. I got this. It was easy to be strong, or what I call strong. It just ate me up. Well, I put all I could in that picture and that painting. He never caught me crying. But like I thought about that over and over because, how these kids, a teacher I work with at Whitehall, and when I draw these faces and I always ask, can we write a story, a narrative? Like it was a double way to get them to write, to talk, to say a dream. Yeah. Without telling they're saying a dream. It's a way to I am, and it's a way to get the perpetual I am out of someone. The perpetual, if you say, and then you are, and the I am and you are meet, it's like, this is the affirmative. Like it's even if, okay, let me say this. If I'm working with a kid and I know he's going to get kicked out of school because of his patterns, I know he's going to do this and the other, but I just draw this picture and get it to him and just be honorable or keep a promise as an adult. It breaks something off. It breaks the chain of like, I can't, I'm inferior. It's just like this. See, I think when a baby's born and they're touched, these endorphins, heal them. But if kids aren't touched and they become hurt, and I think they become prone to be able to be, well, this is a pretty leap shortly, a Jeffrey Dahmer or someone that has mental problems, because the endorphins that from touch that are released in the body and the humanity in human. That's why I think the charge for me is to comfort humanity with this human touch, even though and I think that there's something about the hug that releases an affirmation, even as an adult or as anybody or any and when someone's grieving or any situation. We're taught to be careful and professional and all these things, but every now and again, I'm ready to take the fall and just hug and get through it and get mad at or whatever. But there's something that's releasing that, and I forgot what I was talking about because I just went right around a mountain here.
No, you did. That was an incredible answer. I was talking about youth and building lineage, and that is maybe the best possible answer to that. My last question is maybe simpler, and it's just what is bringing you joy and pleasure in the moment right now, be it seasonal or in your artistic season or what have you?
Well, seeing the next generation step into a space and a place. Smokey Brown, this older artist that I met, they called a folk artist. He'd always say, use your gift, Ricky. My name is Richard Duarte Brown. So people that know me as family call me Ricky or Rick, because my son's name is Ricky. But he said, use your gift. Amina said, just make your art. And just using your gift and making your art in a space with the next generation, man. And to have this chance to talk to you like this, I feel like, wow, it's the next generation listening to you, the next generation hearing you. This is what family is really about. My work's really about finding family. And I don't mind dropping a tear for finding family, because it's tears of joy. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely, brother. It's been a real pleasure. And we both have roots on the east side of the city, and to get to be witness to not only the art that you're making now, but the legacy of art that you're building for generations and generations and generations. You know what? My hope is that we make all the artists who came before us proud. You know, I think that we're doing our best, and I appreciate you because you push me to keep doing my best.
Same here. Thank you.
It started as a normal day.
What if the truth about the greatest tragedy of your life was kept secret from you?
Huge explosion occurred.
This is the story of a scandal deliberately buried in the chaos of the Iraq War.
What really just happened?
Listen to NPR's Embedded podcast and its latest series, Taking Cover.
At the end of every episode, I take some time to share one of my small joys, and I don't have much affection for springtime. Spring in Columbus, at least, is probably my least favorite of the seasons that we have here, in part because the older I get and the more severe the climate emergency becomes, it seems as though shrinking seasons are kind of happening everywhere. The experience of seasons, that is, that are shrinking. Now, this happens in Columbus, I think, most prominently with spring and fall, but I think especially with spring. I feel like spring now has almost dissolved into maybe a month if you're lucky. And so my relationship with spring is a bit challenging, but what I do love most about what the season that kind of represents what spring is to us now is the kind of beginning moments of it, the infancy of it, not necessarily because of the immediate change in weather or the change in daylight hours, you know, being more robust, but I really like just seeing people outside again, almost in awe of the fact that there is sun on their face and that there is kind of a warmth that betrays even, you know, what the ground looks like. It can be like still muddy and wet and a little looking a bit like the ground is infected with a chill. But then, you know, you're outside in shorts and, you know, you're biking or skateboarding or going on a run. And so I have this practice that I kind of try to do when I'm home, if I can. I go to Schiller Park, and there's a bench at Schiller Park. I do like one lap around Schiller Park. When I walk, I go to take a lap around the park, and then I sit on a bench with a couple poetry books and some headphones on, and I just kind of read for 30 minutes or 40 minutes. It's not really... You know, of course I could do this at home. I could do this in my house In the winter, I certainly did do it in my house a great deal. But there is something about being outside and walking in the park. And occasionally I will, of course, take my headphones off to hear the joyful sounds of the park. And then just reveling in some stillness. I sit underneath a tree and I sit across from a tree that where the rose blossoms were blooming, and then they kind of like fell to the ground. And so now the tree is kind of the base of the tree is kind of adorned with that shedding. But I also have a spot that's directly across from the kind of like center of the park, where I don't know if people are familiar with Schiller Park, but if you go during the week from around, I would say like 5:15 to 6:30-ish, there's a dog meetup. I don't know how coordinated it is. I don't really ever talk to people. I just like watching the dogs, because people will bring their dogs and kind of like take some off leash, and then they'll just run around and hang out. And sometimes you see the same dogs, and those same dogs are seeing the same dogs. And it's almost like watching an organized play date with both humans and their companions. And that is also just like immensely joyful, to be stuck in the world of a poem, another joyful world, and then glance up and be immersed in another joyful world of dogs reintroducing themselves to each other, and then having a bit of time together, and then the people who own those dogs or who are companions to those dogs having a bit of time together. And it's a reminder of how this web of connection can grow when the weather permits. So that has been joyful for me. I hope you're finding a park, and I hope you're finding some sunlight to bask in and maybe something good to read. Small Joys is a production of WOSU Public Media and part of the NPR Network. The show is produced and edited by Michael DeBonis, sound engineered by Eric French. Nick Hauser is the Chief Content Director of Digital Media. Thanks to Leticia Wiggins for editorial support, and thank you for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to rate it on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and we'll be back next week with more Small Joys.